Welcome to KAZI Book Review. I'm Holton Hay, coming to you every Sunday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. and every Monday from 8 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. to discuss the latest in literature and books. My guest today on KAZI Book Review is Dr. Deborah Gabriel. She is the co-editor of Inside the Ivory Tower, Narratives of Women of Color Surviving and Thriving in British Academia. Deborah is a senior lecturer at Bournemouth University in the Faculty of Media and Communication. Her work is largely focused on embedding social justice and equality into teaching, research, and professional practice. She is also the founder and director of British Black Academics, an influential network of intellectuals and scholar activists focused on tackling racial inequality in higher education. And Deborah, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you very much.
So Deborah, you say that the book's focus is highlighting the lack of regard for race in discussions around gender equality and the exclusion of race when examining women's experiences as academics in Britain. Now, there may be some who think sort of in a naive way that when it comes to academia, all the issues of race and gender inequality have been conquered. But your experiences and those of your fellow nine writers who are academics who wrote in your book, that is actually not the case.
No, it's not the case at all. And I think that we share that experience with women of color in the U.S. And I think that what prompted me to develop this project on race and gender was really seeing that there's been a lot of focus in higher education on gender equality, but the strategies that have been developed have largely not benefited women of color, because first of all, there's no or little understanding of how race and gender impacts women of color. And secondly, unless there's a conscious effort to say, how are different women impacted by gender inequality, it always defaults to the experiences of white women. And so we've been forced to set up a network in which we've got a mission to promote empowerment and to address race and gender inequality, not just in higher education, but beyond it as well. And so a sisterhood, you know, has kind of evolved and developed. And I felt it was really important that it shouldn't just be about comforting each other about our experiences of inequality. If we're to affect change, we have to be active. And so I thought, well, the first step really to trying to address the fact that we're marginalized within discussions and policy around gender equality is to provide that knowledge. And so I think that people are more engaged with issues around inequality, not by looking at facts and figures, because people hear facts and figures all the time and it goes in one ear and out the other. But when they actually hear people's testimonies, things that have happened to them and how they've dealt with them, that people are more engaged. And so the book is a collection of autoethnographies, and that's where women are not just talking about their experiences, but theorizing and analyzing those experiences. And we used critical race theory because, you know, it's very important in terms of recognizing that racial injustice, it's ingrained, it's embedded, it's normalized. People don't notice.
Now, I'm going to jump in real quick because you use an academic term, critical race theory. So break down critical race theory.
Well, actually, critical race theory began in the U.S. Amongst legal profession and activists. And it was about trying to demonstrate how race produced different legal outcomes. And it spread to other disciplines, particularly education. But I think the key thing about it, it's about recognizing that race in America, racial inequality, is normalized. People don't see it, particularly those people that don't experience racial inequality don't see it. And it's also very much centered on justice. It's not just about saying, oh, isn't it a pity, you know, that we've got racial inequality. It's about finding concrete ways to make a difference.
One of the quotes that were was in your book, and it's from Hazel V. Carby, that I thought was just very enlightening. It says, of white feminism, we must ask, what exactly do you mean when you say we?
And I felt that very strongly. And I talked, you know, in my chapter, you know, about the fact that the reason why we needed to come together as a sisterhood of women of color was because I find that white feminists will use quotes from black feminist famous people like Kimberly Crenshaw and Patricia Hill Collins, and they'll cite black feminism as if we're all part of this sisterhood together. But when you look at feminism, it marginalizes not just the experiences, but the contributions of women of color as well. They write us into the history of emancipation of women by sticking us in the kind of third phase, you know, of this feminist movement, which is just absolutely ridiculous, because the women, black women, not just in the US, but the world over, have been battling against patriarchy. And in some cultures, there is no patriarchy because the communities are led by women anyway. And so I love that quote by Hazel Carby, what do you mean we? Because number one, they don't acknowledge their privilege that they have as white women. One thing that I find amusing and annoying at the same time is sometimes when I've had discussions with white colleagues that genuinely do feel that they are progressive. And when I start talking about racial inequality, they join in and they start blaming everything on white men, you know? And it's like, well, hold on a minute. What about your privilege as a white woman? You know, issues around racial inequality, they're not exclusively to be attributed to white men, because actually white women also have to recognize the ways in which historically some white women objected to black women being included in gender equality. In fact, a lot of white women voted against the emancipation of slaves because they thought that black men would be higher up the social scale than them. So I think that you can't use that term we unless you're going to acknowledge your privilege as a white woman, and you're going to actually take steps to address racial inequality. Otherwise, don't use the term we.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Deborah Gabriel. She is the co-editor of Inside the Ivory Tower, Narratives of Women of Color Surviving and Thriving in British Academia. So one of the things that was brought out in the book was that the term intersectionality has been appropriated by some white feminist scholars, even though the origins of intersectionality are in black feminist thought. And in particular, one of the academics, one of the intellectuals quoted a lot in your book is Patricia Hill Collins, who's the author of Black Feminist Thought, Knowledge, Consciousness, and the Politics of Empowerment. So let's start off with intersectionality and how that came up, became part of Black Feminist Thought.
I mean, I think that intersectionality, even before the term was coined, has always been an integral part of Black feminist thought. Because of the fact that there was a recognition, not just amongst scholars, because that's one thing I'd say about black feminism, is that it's not this exclusive domain that is only concerned with and includes scholars. It's about recognizing the ways in which black women in general have contributed to gender equality and have struggled as well. So it's very inclusive, I feel. But intersectionality has always been embedded in Black feminist thought because there was always a recognition that inequality as experienced by women of color wasn't just on one level. It wasn't just because of the color of your skin. It was also combined with the inequalities that gender create and class as well. And if you think about poverty being more entrenched amongst communities of color, then there's a class component of it. And so Patricia Hill Collins and other Black feminist scholars have always argued about this kind of tripartite experience of inequality. And of course, that was developed further with Kimberly Crenshaw and her legal arguments, you know, to explain how Black women were impacted in the criminal justice system and how their race and their gender and the class produce particular legal outcomes that meant that we were not living in a system where the justice system was just.
One of the interesting things, and you brought it up, is this whole issue of middle class ethos and how teachers and curriculum are developed assuming the kids are white middle class students. And one of the examples I've seen in general is there are summer camps in Austin that are designed for half day. And you think about working class people who cannot afford to take off half a day to go pick up their kids. Or if they take off half a day to go pick up their kids, then they will have to give up that salary or that hourly wage for that time period. So it was one of the things I thought about, how some of these summer camps are really designed under the assumption that you're coming from a middle-class family where the one of the parents doesn't work, or you could just take the time off and still get paid for that. So talk a little bit about that tripartite again of that intersectionality of race and gender, or at least race and the class, and how it affects the access to resources for African-American and Black kids all over the country, all over the world.
I mean, I think that's a really, really important point. And I think that these inequalities occur every day on so many levels, and people are oblivious to them. But I think that sometimes those inequalities are masked by this buy-in to diversity as being, oh, as long as people can say that they don't see color, as long as people can say that they think we're all equal, that that's going to address these economic disparities that happen every day, that also have are connected to history. So we see the ways in which, and I've certainly learned more about that when I was in New York and I did the Inside Out slavery tour and learned a lot about Wall Street and learned about the ways, you know, in which certain communities became enriched, right, through the free labor of others. And those historical wealth gaps still exist today. How can you have equality when there's never any attempt to redress those? And that means that where you have working class communities of color and you have wealth gaps that still exist today that were created by slavery, how are you going to make up for that? How are you going to create equality if you're not going to address those? It means that people can't participate in certain things that people take for granted, such as summer camp, you know, because they don't have vast amounts of wealth. It means that people can't live in certain places. I did a tour of Clarksville, which was, you know, really culturally enriching to see where the first freed people lived and what they made, you know, how they created these very strong communities. But it's sad today to see that there's not many black families living in that area. Why is that? And it, the same things happened in other areas where there's gentrification, and that happens in the UK as well. That what used to be, you know, the kind of a heart of a black community or a community of colour, is not that anymore. And it's really sad. And to me, it's a continuation of a historical injustice. So I don't see how someone can feel progressive, feel and say they don't see colour, they don't see race, but yet you might be living a life of privilege that's only afforded to you because of the historical injustices that were meted out onto communities of colour. And for me, it's not about diversity, it's about equity, it's about equality, and it's about how can we redress those wrongs, because it's not just a social wrong, they're economic wrongs as well.
One of the challenges you talked about is that you're supposed to be grateful that they allowed you at the campus, and therefore you come under pressure not to talk about racism, but you actually have, and have obviously addressed it with the book. Talk about those challenges where they say you should be happy you're there, but we really don't want you to talk about the underlying racism, discrimination, people of color face in academia.
I think that when I was doing my undergraduate degree, and that was as a very mature student, I should say, and I saw how Eurocentric the curriculum was, how we're kind of not included in it, and if we might be occasionally mentioned, I kind of got the sense that as people of colour, that we were supposed to feel that progress has been made because we're actually at the university. But it's not just about getting numbers in higher education, it's about what kind of experience do we have within the system. It's about whether the system is created for us. And I think that at the moment, the system is one that was not created for us, but one in which we're expected to assimilate. And I think that I've been inspired, even before I went to university, by a lot of people. After my mum died, in the early 90s, I wanted to find out more about where she came from. My mum was born in Cuba, but the family was from Jamaica. And so I spent almost 2 years there. And it had such a profound experience on me, living in a black country. And I really have seen the difference that it has on your psyche, growing up and being educated in a society in which black people are in the majority, and growing up in a white society in which you're always the outsider and you're always socialized to believe that we're somehow inferior. And when I came back from Jamaica, I had a completely different outlook on life. And I wanted to know more about our histories. And I read a lot of books then. And initially, I always read factual books because, you know, I thought that was how to learn. And I think maybe it was about that time that I read some novels. And one of them was Toni Morrison's Beloved, which was about slavery. And the thing is that, again, I remember growing up, you know, as a black woman in British society, and, you know, you weren't expected, you know, to talk about slavery and stuff like that. That's all in the past. you know, look to the future, keep your head down, whatever. And the thing is, it had such a profound experience on me. And to this day, that's why I think that we learn more through lived experience than just looking at facts and figures, because the stories that she told, you know, about the experiences of the people in it, Seth, and what they had gone through and what she had to do and what the slavery and the brutalization forced her to do, it made me feel like I was back in time there. It really made me appreciate what my ancestors went through, how complex that story is of slavery and the impact that it had. And I think that that's what drew me, you know, to Black feminism, because it's very much about our experiences and telling them in ways that are meaningful to us. So, you know, it was really sad to see that Toni Morrison passed away this week. But actually, when I did the slavery tour in New York, I thought of Toni Morrison, because I went back to her book, you know, and that story, and I thought, my God, it's here in New York, it's here at this corner where the slave market was, and it's here in the African burial ground. It's just amazing.
Yeah, for me, Toni Morrison, I got introduced to her at the neighborhood library I worked at when I was about 16 or 17, and I got to read The Bluest Eye that had come out earlier, and I read Song of Solomon, Tar Baby, Jazz. As those books were coming out, I started reading them, and I quickly discovered there was no one better of chronicling the Black experience, the pain, the joy, the passion, the challenges. And she's really one of the great writer, period, of the 20th and 21st century. And for me, her books are like part of the canon, and one of the most important writers definitely of my generation, and I think in, you know, American and global literature.
I mean, you know, I totally, totally agree with that. And I think that it's the stories. I think that it's the stories that she tells that reveal the complexities, but also, as much as, you know, it's really upsetting sometimes to read about these things, but there's always the story of resilience in there. It shows you how bad things were, but also how we survived as well. And I think that that's a really important message that she's given to the world.
One of the things I thought was really interesting that you said in your essay in the book Inside the Ivory Tower was, ironically, while invisibility is a key dimension of our experiences as Black women in higher education, hypervisibility is equally problematic. Elaborate on that.
Okay, so there's so few of us in higher education, and we're scattered around. And I guess, just to put it into some perspective, there's probably about 300,000 academics working in higher education in the UK. And of that figure, probably there's only around 5,000 to 6,000 black academics. And when we look at progression in higher education, again, there's around 20,000 professors working in higher education, and only around 130 professors are black. And of that figure, probably only around 35 are black women. So,
wow.
Yeah, wow. And so, on the one hand, there's so few of us, we can be invisible. But then again, if you're the only black woman working in your department or your faculty, there's also a hypervisibility. And when I finished my PhD in 2014, and I went to work at Bournemouth University, at the time, I think I was only one of two women of colour in the department, and the only black woman. And I thought, well, there's no walking around with your head down here. Actually, I might as well use that to my advantage. I am the only black person, so I don't have to worry about introducing myself, because everybody must know I'm Deborah Gabriel, because I'm the only black woman in the department. But to be fair, at the time that I went to work at Bournemouth University, I had already set up Black British Academics that year. And that was partly because from the time I entered higher education as an undergraduate student to finishing my PhD, I felt that there's so few of us, we're so isolated, that initially I set up Black British Academics because I wanted to connect with other black academics. But it quickly became not just about having a network to socialize, but actually that we wanted to tackle racial inequality. And so because I'd set up the network and it'd been in existence, I didn't feel when I joined the university and there were so few people of color, I didn't feel that isolation because I already felt as if I was part of a community.
Dr. Deborah Gabriel, author of Inside the Ivory Tower, Narratives of Women of Color Surviving and Thriving in British Academia. Thank you for being a guest on KZR Book Review.
Thank you very much for having me.